Welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program addressing the ramifications of change in our communities and beyond, and how today's choices will impact tomorrow's community. Today's host is Chris Kington Barker, and our program is being recorded today, so unfortunately we can't take your call live, but we do invite you to send any follow-up questions that you might have from this interesting conversation today to voices@kcbx.org. We're keeping it short today, so now let's join Chris and our guest. Over to you, Chris.
Thank you, Brad. My guest today, Eve Newhouse, is author of Red Vienna. She's the former San Luis Obispo resident and former owner of Mama Ganache, which we very fondly remember. Red Vienna is the first book in a three-volume series, Two Suitcases, based on stories of the author's parents shared about their youth in the urban utopia of Vienna, Austria, between World War I and II. The first volume, Red Vienna, occurs between 1949 and 1934, when the main characters meet in the socialist youth movement. The core of this book lies in the efforts to establish a peaceful, egalitarian society built from the ruin of the First World War and decades of poverty caused by the early urban industrialization. While the book is fiction, the story of Red Vienna is not. It may be unknown to many of us after being overshadowed by the World War events of World War II, the rise of Hitler, fascism, the Holocaust, and the Nazi movement to take over Europe. We'll be talking about these events of the past and how this story has relevance to the events of today. And Eve, I want to welcome you today.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Yes, and thank you for the book. It was for me very interesting reading, and honestly, not history that I was very familiar with.
That's pretty common.
Yeah, I can appreciate that. And you know, for you, talk a little bit about what it was for you to want to write this story. And I'm assuming you had to do a lot of research.
Yeah. It was a tremendous amount of research. That's why it took me from 2015 to this year to get it out, because of all the research. I originally wanted to write it because, well, I'll tell you the story because it has a local aspect in it. I went to see Woman in Gold with Helen Mirren at the Palm when it came out in 2015. And it was a great movie, and I love Helen Mirren. And I came out of that theater and I said, you know, my parents' story is as good as this story. I ought to write it down. So I started to think about writing it down really for the first time. Pretty soon, I realized how little I knew, because my parents didn't really talk about it. They didn't want to share the bad parts. They shared some of the good parts, a few of the exciting stories, but basically it was this long blank between when they met in 1929 to when they came to the United States in 1942. So I had to start subscribing to the archives of newspapers and reading everything I could find. I taught many years middle grades, and I used to teach history using historical fiction. So it occurred to me that I could fictionalize it and make it more accessible and more compelling than just telling the story as nonfiction. And then I had to put the imaginative part in too.
How did, you know, are some of the characters real characters, or are they all fictionalized? Were some of this, some of the story around people who were real?
Yeah, there are a lot of people who are real in the book. The main characters are based on my parents. Gizi and Max are based on my parents. Anna is based on my father's sister. Emil is based on a family friend who was still a family friend many years after the events took place. All the main characters are based on real characters whom I grew up with as my aunts and uncles, even though I wasn't actually related to them. And then there are a few characters who are historical characters who were either part of my life or I inserted them into the book. The most important of those characters is a man called Ernst Papanek, whom my aunt and my mother worked for in Paris in 1938 to 1940, bringing Jewish children out of Germany and Austria and housing them in a chateau north of Paris in a place called Montmorency. He was my Uncle Ernst. I didn't realize that he was a relatively famous man until about maybe 1985 or 1986, when I came across his memoir in a library book sale in Ithaca, New York, and recognized his name. Mm-hmm. And I immediately bought up, I had a friend who was an antiquarian book dealer, I immediately bought up every book I could of this, it was called Out of the Fire by Ernst Papanek, because there was my family history.
Yeah.
And I sent it to my kids and I sent it to everybody I knew. And I said, look, this is part of who I am. And I was already, I don't know, 35 years old.
Yeah.
At that point.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about this movement that is happening. Talk a little bit about, you know, the central characters of the book in Red Vienna. One of the central characters is the SDAP. Talk about what the SDAP is.
Okay, so at the end of World War I, Austria, which lost the war, was reduced from a huge empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Habsburg Empire, into this little tiny landlocked country. With the capital of the imperial capital of Central Europe, Vienna, at its center, surrounded by the Alps. And it was very poor because it had lost all its territory. So things were very bad in 1918. There was the flu epidemic. And there were millions of refugees coming into Vienna. And they were coming because it was the Industrial Revolution, and they thought they could get work. And there were indeed factories sprouting up everywhere, and there were tenements to house them. And the conditions, as you can imagine, were terrible. Yeah. The work hours were really awful. Tuberculosis was rampant. People were literally starving, and they were living in apartments. Yeah, squalor, total squalor. So unexpectedly, the Social Democratic Party of Austria was elected to be the first government of the Republic of Austria in 1918. I think they were as surprised as anybody. But they had a visionary leader, Otto Bauer, and they decided that they were going to use the socialist philosophy of redistributing the wealth and helping the workers rise out of poverty to create a workers' utopia. And by 1929, when the book opens, that utopia was really at its peak. At the center of the plan was a really ambitious social housing program. By the time the book opens, I think there were 14 social housing complexes around the city of Vienna or in the city of Vienna, all built, designed by famous architects. And they were complete cities within cities. They provided all social services. They provided schools, doctors, stores, theaters,
libraries,
lecture halls, medical service, mm-hmm. And communal kitchens, communal gardens, communal laundromats. You could live your whole life within these small cities, a city within a city. They were very successful. They had some flaws, mm-hmm. But they were remarkably successful. And the characters in my book come of age in that era, when things were really, really going well for the Social Democratic Party. And all of the characters in my book were born into the Social Democratic Party. So they were raised in a scout program that indoctrinated them in the ideas. And then they came of age. My parents met, and the characters in my book meet at the second International Youth Conference, Socialist Youth Conference in 1929, which was quite an event.
And with this Social Democratic Party and all of the building they did, and these buildings still exist.
Yes.
And they're still housing units. And I think one of them in the material that you sent me to do research for this show, one of them has like 5,000 units.
Yeah.
They're tremendous. But it took people from not having electricity and running water, not having shelter, to having all of those things and more. And it was funded by taxing the wealthy.
That's right.
And having the wealthy provide for essentially leveling the playing field so that people who were the have-nots could have more of the distribution of the wealth.
Exactly.
Yeah. So this effort really took place for a period of time, and it was something, but it was also a real pacifist movement.
Yeah.
It was not something that was done forcefully at all. Right.
Right.
Go ahead.
Okay. The Social Democratic Party was actually divided. All political parties in Austria at the time had a paramilitary branch. That was part of what a political party was, to have a paramilitary. So the Schutzbund was the paramilitary branch of the Social Democratic Party, but the political branch was strongly pacifist because Otto Bauer, who was the visionary, was strongly pacifist.
Right.
So my parents and the characters, hence the characters, really were against war. It came out of a terrible, terrible war,
mm-hmm.
and they never wanted that to happen again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and these units now housed people of all religions, all backgrounds.
So that's right.
Your family was Jewish.
My father's family was Jewish. My mother's family was lapsed Catholic. They were both lapsed. It was a secular society. Religion was the opiate of the masses.
Yeah. Okay. So this book continues, and what we see in the transition of Austria, what was the relationship during this time of Austria and Germany? And I'm going to take a real quick break and just say that you are listening to Central Coast Voices. I'm Chris Kington Barker. And the voice that you hear with me today is Eve Newhouse, author of Red Vienna, and also a former resident of San Luis Obispo. This show has been pre-recorded, so we won't be able to take your questions. However, you can write us at centralcoastvoices.org and at kcbx.org, and we can always get your questions to Eve, and she can answer them for you. So, Eve, what was the relationship between Austria and Germany at this time?
Well, Germany was a Protestant country, and Austria was a Catholic country. And that was a big part of the relationship. And that's why Austria didn't want to become part of, even though it was German speaking.
Yes.
They didn't want to become part of Germany. Even though, even before Hitler, there was a pan-German movement to unite both countries for the economic advantage. And it would have been helpful for the little tiny Austria to become part of the larger Germany, except for this Protestant Catholic rift.
You moved from here in the US to France how many mm-hmm. years ago?
We moved in 2018. We sold Mama Ganache in 2017, and we moved in 2018.
And recently, you know, I think for us here in the U.S., where we see a couple of political parties and we see factions of it, certainly more now, what are you seeing as you've done a lot of research and certainly as you're in Europe now? Do you see some of the similarities between what's happened as you did research for this book and what you're seeing in Europe and maybe even the U.S. now?
I definitely do. Several weeks ago, when I gave a talk at the UU in San Luis, people asked me the same questions. And at that point, I was very pessimistic. I said at that point, you know, I see authoritarians rising all over the world, and I think it's perhaps an inevitable wave. The pendulum swings democratic, the pendulum, then it swings back to an authoritarian style of leadership. But in the last 3 weeks, two things have happened that have given me a great deal of hope. The election in England and the recent election in France, that these things make me feel like democracy is still alive, at least in England and France, and that the people can rise up and unite, especially what happened in France, where parties united that have been bickering for many, many years, and they did a campaign that lasted 1 week that turned the whole situation around. I'm feeling very hopeful right now, if the leftists can stop arguing among themselves.
And you talk a little bit about in case people aren't aware of what happened recently in France. Can you give a kind of a quick overview of that?
So in France, the far right has been rising in power over maybe the last 20 years. I live in a part of France that has been traditionally socialist. I have neighbors. It's a very international village, and people move there because of what it is. And people moved there because it was a socialist village. It was a leftist village. Mm-hmm. And yet, the last two elections, the left barely won the last legislative election, and then the current snap election, which, no, I'm wrong, the European, the EU, hang on a second. The EU election, the right wing won in our village, which was very shocking. So I think that the EU election, which was about a month ago, really sent waves of terror through the centrists and the leftists in Europe. And as a result, they formed a coalition. The way the elections work in France is that there are two voting times and they're a week apart. So the first vote is to narrow the field to just the winners. So there were 38 groups that ran, 38 parties that ran in the first election. And in the first election, the right wing did very, very well. So in the week between the two elections, four groups from the 37 parties, the four largest groups, the socialists, the Greens, a second socialist party, and the communists, banded together and had a campaign which was based on the idea that the last time France had a far-right government was the Vichy regime in World War II. And in France, people remember history, and they came out and voted. And now the far left has the majority of the seats in the lower parliament. The centrists have the second number, and the far right has the third. It's still too many, but they don't have the power to put the program in that they would have liked to put in, which was very anti-immigrant.
And you see that as having people finding a way to coalesce around a bigger, more extraordinary harm that could have been done.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. And you're seeing that some of that was an effort in this book.
Yep. In the book, I think the book is interesting because it really documents the very incremental rise of fascism and anti-Semitism. The characters who have exceptionally open eyes and open minds, even these people who are so bright and so committed, are surprised at the end, which I won't share.
Yeah, no, you won't share, and I won't share it either. Yes. And so talk a little bit about with your, you know, you and I have very similar parent backgrounds in terms of my mother was German and spent a lot of time in Vienna. So comes from a period, I think she's probably a little bit younger than your parents. Mm-hmm. She was born in 1924. So mm-hmm. I don't know mm-hmm. when your parents were
yeah.
born.
Yeah, about 10 years before that.
Mm-hmm. But for her, she talked very little
yeah.
about what occurred during the war, either very right. few stories. It was, and she went through her teenage years during World War II.
Right.
So, and trying to go back and forth because she got married to a man from Vienna, trying to get back and forth between Vienna and Germany was not easy because they got closed off.
Right.
There was a shutdown between the two. And at first, you needed to pay extraordinary amounts to get between the two. And then you had to be smuggled
right.
back between the two.
Right.
So, for you and your parents, was there a change in how you saw your parents when you began to do this exploration?
Oh, absolutely. I really had no idea what heroes they were.
Talk
you know,
about
you,
that.
You grow up with your family, and it's yeah. just your family, and then you're a teenager, yeah. and you know everything, so.
Right. And you don't think much of what they are, yeah.
right. So, I respected my parents because they were really outliers. They taught me from a very early age not to follow the crowd. They were very wary of any kind of mob mentality, any kind of conformist thinking. They really taught me to think independently.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So their values were great. In the summer, they sent me to a Quaker intentional community.
That's interesting.
Where I again learned activism. It was during the civil rights era.
Yeah. yeah.
So I learned all those things from them, and I really respected them for having those ideas. But I didn't realize personally what they did. And I didn't realize how respected my father was in particular in his group and in the among the people whom he helped to get out of Europe, which I had no idea.
I can appreciate that. Yeah, that we don't see our parents as we are. And there is a secrecy about it. And we don't know how much of it is trauma and how much of it is just not
exactly.
wanting to go back.
Yeah, exactly.
But there's as a child, you probably experienced this too. I knew that there was a barrier of don't go there. You know, you just have a sense that's not
right.
the place
exactly.
that you tread to.
Exactly. My parents didn't teach me German. They spoke English at home. I went to kindergarten with a Viennese accent, but they cut themselves off.
Yeah, yeah, interesting. We are going to take a brief break here, and Brad, I'm going to send it back to you for just a few minutes or a minute or two.
Okay.
Would you like to get the word out about a nonprofit or community event? We'd love to help. You can add your event to the KCBX community calendar. Not only will your event be visible on our website, but you're likely to hear about it here on the air, too. It's easy to submit your event. Just visit the community calendar page at kcbx.org and give us the scoop, the date, the time, the place, and a few details. That's the community calendar at kcbx.org.
Hola, I'm Maria Hinojosa. Every Thursday afternoon at 2, you can hear Latino USA on KCBX. Latino USA is a Peabody Award-winning radio journal of news and culture from a Latino-Latina perspective. It chronicles how we're living, shaping, and changing the United States of America. Tune in for in-depth reporting, candid conversations, and fascinating stories. Join me for Latino USA Thursdays from 2 to 3 on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio.
Latino USA is coming up next following this program here on KCBX. Right now, let's return to Chris Kington Barker and her guests on Central Coast Voices. Back to you, Chris.
Welcome back, and welcome back to an interview with Eve Newhouse, author of Red Vienna, former San Luis Obispo resident, and former owner of Mama Ganache. Today's show has been pre-recorded. However, if you have questions or comments for Eve, you can send them to centralcoastvoices@kcbx.org, and we'll make sure that they get over to her. And Eve, question for you. You started working on this book and then you stopped for a bit and then you restarted. Talk a little bit about what happened during that time. What made you put it down and then pick it back up?
Well, I was working on it pretty steadily from 2015 until Trump came into power.
Ah.
And when Trump came in, well, I should tell another little story that is the backstory to this. I didn't know very much about my parents' background at all until I was 11, and I read Anne Frank with my sixth grade class. And when I read Anne Frank, I was shocked. I had no idea. I went to my mother after school, the day we finished the book at school. And I said to her, how come Anne Frank went through all this and you came through the same similar historical setting and none of these things happened to you? And she thought for a little while. And then she said, I think it was because we read the writing on the wall. And that really had a big impact on me. So after that, I had this thing at the back of my mind that I am going to read the writing on the wall too. So when Trump came into power in 2016 or 2017, Steve Bannon came in as his strategist and assistant, and Sebastian Gorka came with Steve Bannon as his right-hand man. And when Sebastian Gorka was sworn into government service, he was wearing a Hungarian Nazi insignia on his lapel. And that was in the news. And I saw that and I said, that's the writing on the wall. We are leaving. So I said to Tom, we have to sell this 7-bedroom, 5-bath house. We have to sell the business and we need to leave. And that day we had a chocolate and beer tasting in Cambria and we drove up the coast and Tom said, how about we go to France? Because he was a lifelong Francophile. And I said, okay. And I looked on my phone for what houses cost in France and I discovered that it was very affordable. So I said, okay, let's move to France. So at that point, I pretty much dropped everything and started emptying the house and trying to get the business into a shape where it was saleable. And it took until 2018 when we went to France and bought a little house pretty impulsively. And then we finished off what we had to do in California. And here we are. So I stopped writing completely at that point. I just set it aside. I thought if this gets finished, it gets finished. We thought we were moving to the north of France at that point, or to the west of France, because we have friends who live there. When we came, that area was too rural for me, and it was too French. I didn't feel comfortable. So instead, we looked near where my parents had been in hiding from 1940 to 1942. That's the third volume of the book, which isn't written yet. And that's the part of the story that was very idyllic, that my mother especially talked to me about. They lived on a farm. They raised geese. It was a lovely time in their lives. The war went on around them, and they were safe. So they didn't want to move to a little village where they were hiding in a village of 300, but they liked the nearby city, which is called Montauban, which is a city of about 50,000, very much. So I said to Tom, let's go to Montauban. So we went to Montauban, and we looked around to see if we could rent a place for a year. But while we were there, it became obvious to us that Montauban, even though it had been a very interesting place during the war, and the American Friends Service Committee had an outreach program there, and there was lots of resistance base there, it had switched. It was a working class place. And like many working class places, it had already gone right wing 11 years before we got there. And it was not the place that we wanted to live. But we had friends who lived there, and they recommended that we spend the last 2 days that we had in our Airbnb being tourists. So we went to see the hilltop and we went to see the Bastides in the area. Those are fortified villages, fortified medieval villages. And the second one we saw was a place called Courtes-sur-Ciel. It was an artist's colony. It was very cosmopolitan. And we fell in love with it. We bought a house. So then we moved. So once we moved, I suddenly had the time to start writing again. So because it was a place with many English speakers from all over the world, a friend and I organized a writer's group. And I spent the next 2 years working very seriously on the book again. And the group recommended at that point that Two Suitcases was too large a project. So they suggested that I cut it into three parts. So I cut off the first piece and I started rewriting it so that it would be a novel that could stand on its own with a beginning, middle, and end. That was finished. Barely finished, right at the beginning of COVID. So COVID hit, and suddenly everything shut down, and I felt like the book had no relevance anymore. I felt like it was already the end of the world. Why did I need to write a book that was a warning, a cautionary tale about what happened before? So I put it down again. Part of the way through, a friend encouraged me to send it to agents and publishers as it was, because it was ready. And I did that, but I was not successful in getting an agent or a publisher because it was COVID. Nobody was publishing books. So COVID finished, and I started watching what was happening in the world because I was always interested in politics. My parents, I grew up on politics. That's what one discusses at dinner. So I was following the politics around the world, and I felt more and more compelled to write this book. So I decided, okay, I'm going to do one more round, and I'm going to publish it. So I self-published it, and here it is.
And, you know, with all of that, too, what, you know, you talk about how you saw the writing on the wall, and that kind of created this whole movement for you to leave a place here, and that you were very settled and very happy at one point, right?
Yeah.
And uproot into the unknown. And you talk about now with France that you were feeling really awful. And then now, after 3 weeks of this tour and what happened in France recently, you're feeling hope again. How is this transition for you from reading the writing on the wall to where you are now?
When we first moved to France, I felt this great sense of relief, because I think that I was raised in a European family. even though my parents tried really, really hard to be American, and I was raised in the suburbs.
Yes.
I still had, you know, my mother sent me to school with sandwiches on rye bread.
I get it.
And even though they learned English and spoke English exclusively, they had very heavy accents. Mm-hmm. And I always was an outsider. And when we came to Europe, even though we weren't living in Austria, you know, I had this attachment to France because I had this fantasy of how lovely the south of France was. I came to Europe and I felt at home. I discovered how hard it is to learn a language when you are 68.
Yeah.
And hard of hearing.
Yeah.
Oh, it is a bear. I had some French in high school and even a little in college, but you don't learn the language. I was basically starting from scratch. I am very, very lucky that I live in a cosmopolitan place where, even though I do speak French now, and I can get by, and I can even follow a good deep discussion, the words don't always come out of my mouth. I'm not comfortable in French as comfortable as I am in English. But I have a cosmopolitan community where the lingua franca is English.
How is it for you coming back to the States to do this book tour, to talk about this book, to share this during the political climate that exists right now in the U.S. and the tensions that exist?
It's been hard. It's been hard because the parallels are so strong. Last night, I gave a book talk here in Pleasanton, and I read part of, I think, chapter 31 or something like that, where the where democracy falls in Austria. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the echoes are just powerful all through the book. It feels like what happened in Austria is happening here. And it's very distressing. Personally, it's been great to be back. I love being with my family. I love being with my old friends. I mean, we lived in California for 20 years, and we have deep roots in San Luis Obispo. Three of our kids live here in the Bay Area. So it's great to be back. I love walking down the street and hearing snatches of conversation in English.
Yeah, yeah.
I love the food. In France, the food is French, which is lovely.
It would be French, yes. What, you know, talk about the association with the color red, why the book is called Red Vienna.
Yeah, that's something that I didn't expect to come up. But it came up when I was on the Dave Congleton show, and a listener called in and said, "What's with red?" And suddenly I realized, oh, people have forgotten that communism was red, that socialism was red, mm-hmm. that the left was red. You remember the movie Reds?
Exactly.
The Red China? That has been overpowered in American culture by the left being blue and the right being red. Yeah. It's been switched.
Yes.
And people have very short memories. But that's why it's Red Vienna, because it was socialist Vienna.
Yeah. What is it about, you know, that in the book, the Nazis and the fascists were the same in the 30s and 40s?
Not exactly. Not exactly. It was two different parties.
Okay.
And they had commonalities.
Commonalities.
Yeah. They were both fascist parties because fascist is it's originally an Italian word that was defined by Mussolini in the 20s.
Right.
And it involves an authoritarian government. It's not democracy. The people are not in power. It's a top-down system with an authoritarian figure, usually a very charismatic figure, at the top. And the power of the people is nil. There is no. It is governed from the top. And it's in most cases, it's corporate. It prefers corporations to small business, and to, because that's part of the power being consolidated at the top. And it's often very harsh. Nazism has an added element, which is that anti-Semitism is part of it. Nazism blames everything that's wrong on one group, or actually on the other, and the Jews happen to personify the other the most, but it was also the gays, the gypsies, everybody that wasn't what the Nazis saw as their national model, their Aryan, blonde-haired, blue-eyed man.
Yeah. I'm Chris Kington Barker with you for Central Coast Voices on KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, your listener-supported radio station. If you've recently joined us for today's show and want to enjoy the entire broadcast, it's available on our website at kcbx.org under the On Demand tab. Click on Central Coast Voices and you'll find this show along with many other past shows to choose from. Eve Newhouse is the author of Red Vienna, former San Luis Obispo resident and former owner of Mama Ganache. She's joining us today from Pleasanton. This is being recorded previously to being aired. We're on Zoom, and we would like you to, if you have questions or comments for Eve, you can send those through to us at voices@kcbx.org, and we'll make sure that she gets them. And so, Eve, talk about, with the experience, the experiments in creating a socialistic society, there are a lot of, I think the term socialism has been thrown around here in the United States.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily what you're talking about in the book. In fact, it's not at all what you're talking about in the book as a socialism. So what are some of the general misconceptions about socialism today?
Socialism in its original form, when it wasn't transmogrified by the communists or the communist Chinese or the communist Russians or other totalitarian regimes which took it on, socialism was about redistribution of the wealth. It was about creating an egalitarian, compassionate, kind society. It changed as it was implemented. Austro-socialism is a very unique form of socialism, which was envisioned by Otto Bauer already. I think he started writing in the teens, maybe even earlier. And it's the softest, gentlest form of socialism. And the experiment in Vienna is probably the softest, gentlest experiment in socialism that has ever existed, or perhaps there are small ones, but of any size that has ever existed. And it was really an effort to create a world where people really were, where the playing field was even. Which involved taking from the rich and giving to the poor.
Yeah, that whole Robin Hood principle.
Yeah.
And does any of that still exist in Vienna now?
There's a socialist party. There are socialist parties all over Europe, which really are closer to the Austro-socialist model than any other socialist model. My parents were Norman Thomas socialists. Norman Thomas ran for the presidency. It really got wiped out in the United States during the McCarthy era. And then it was associated with communism. And it is to this day.
Yeah. Yeah. And there is that confusion that it's always associated with communism.
Yeah. There's a nascent socialist party. There's a wonderful publication. Why does the name slip my mind right now? It'll come. That a magazine that really has very strong, clear ideas about what socialism can be.
What do you hope that people gain from reading this series?
I think that it's incredibly valuable to look at history and work toward it not repeating itself, because I really see history repeating itself now, especially here in the United States, but all over the world. And I see, as in the example of red having switched values, see the history being forgotten. I think that it was very smart of the French in this last week between the elections to have brought up the Vichy regime, because the French, the school system pounds it into the students. It's much more common for people to remember World War II. You know, yeah. Holocaust denial is a big thing in the United States. It's a big thing all over the world, but the United States is the foremost denier of the Holocaust.
Yeah.
And it is so important to remember that so that we can act, so that we can write postcards, so that we can knock on doors, so that we can keep democracy alive, because what's coming is the opposite of democracy. What could come.
And do you feel more hopeful about what can happen here in the U.S. based on what you've seen from what's happened in France? And what do you think it will take to make that occur?
I am more hopeful. If you had heard my talk at the UU, I was not very hopeful at all. When people raised their hands and said, well, we can write postcards, I was thinking, puh. But now, having seen what happened in France in 1 week with basically a single message, which was, remember history, don't let this happen again, collaborate. I think that it can happen here. I think that what is necessary is collaboration, is activism, is talking to your neighbors, starting by being kind to your neighbors and then telling them, reminding them of what could happen and how it happened in Europe in the 1940s. I think talking about it is so important right now. Several people are trying to get my book, which is very accessible. It's really written, you know, I taught fifth grade and middle school, and it's written so that a middle school student can understand it. And now it's coming out in audio in the fall. Mm-hmm. Getting books like mine and mine into the schools, getting these ideas into the public A discourse can still change what might happen. I think it's a huge hill to climb, but I think it's possible.
It is a big hill to climb. One of the things that occurred to me as I was reading the book, because there is so much between the political parties and so much in the history that was happening during that time, I think for people to understand it, it really took having a fictional group of characters to make it more solidly relatable.
Right.
Because you can get lost in all of the different factions and the parties and trying to follow the thread somewhere, it's a lot. But when you're putting it to people, when you see how you've kind of woven the story in between, it makes it much more relatable.
Right. That's why I wrote it as fiction.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you've done all your research now, or are you continuing on doing
No.
your research?
I just thought I could do all the research at the beginning. But that's not true. I do the research chapter by chapter. So now, right now, I'm researching, well, I was before I came to California. I was researching the period in 1938 when they escape. So I do very narrow, pinpointed research as I write.
And is there anything in the writings or anything that your parents left you that you've been able to pull from other than their words? Or did you have to do all this research going to history, going to newspapers?
In 2004, did some research on the family history when he was in Vienna. He went around to archives and pulled up microfiche. And I learned a lot more than I knew before. But in 2017, when I was packing up the house, we came across a box of my mother's papers. My mother lived with us in San Luis for a couple of years. And we found a box that had all of their papers. So all of a sudden, I had all the dates. I had the names of the ships. I had the addresses. So that was really helpful.
Yeah, I'll bet. What are some of the things that stick out in your mind that were most surprising to you that you know now?
I didn't know the story of how the book Red Vienna ends. I had no idea. And I won't share it, but that really just blew me away when I read about that.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was the biggest one.
Yeah, that you had no idea. And that really isn't something that comes out in the history.
No. No, it wasn't in the newspapers at the time.
No.
The victors write the histories. The socialists lost. The Jews lost.
Yeah. 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 And with that, you know, for people, then the next book is going to be what period of time?
The next book takes place from 1934 to 1938, when the characters go underground and continue their activism and eventually leave at the end of the book in 1938 because they have to.
Yeah. How do you suppose that you will bring all of this together? Do you have an ending in sight here, or it's going to evolve as it evolves?
Well, I know how the second book ends, and okay, I have a pretty good idea of how the third book ends, but I have to write it and I have to do the research to be sure.
Okay. Have you written before now?
I have. I wrote two other books. I wrote a middle grades fantasy that was published in 2006. It's called Journey to Mythica. And then I wrote a memoir about my years in the 1970s and early 80s with an Indian guru, which was published in 2010. It's called The Crazy Wisdom of Ganesh Baba.
And is this the first time that you've done research on a book?
This is the first historical fiction that I've written. Okay. So when I began this process, the first thing I did was watch a lot of YouTubes of, I like historical fiction. So I chose my favorite writers and I found YouTube videos about their process. And when I started writing, Diana Gabaldon was really big. And she writes marvelous historical fiction, fantasy, melanges. Mm-hmm. And her system is to write each piece like a little pearl and then to string them together into a necklace. And she doesn't write her books chronologically. So I tried that first, but I wasn't successful. So I tried to write it chronologically. But I still do the same thing. Each chapter, I try to make it into a little pearl before I go on to the next chapter.
So, have you gone back to Vienna to visit some of these places so that you were able to visualize? I mean, you're able to see the places that you're writing about?
I actually haven't been back to Vienna since 1994 when my aunt died. She was living there. I had planned to go back to Vienna, and I had a two-week tour with a tour of Red Vienna, with a guide, all set up for February of 2020, which is when COVID hit. Then we made another plan to go back after that second wave of COVID. So I haven't been back, but I'm planning to go back in September. So the second book will be more rooted in my actual experience. But the internet is marvelous.
It is indeed. You don't have to go, you don't have to physically get on a train in order to see the places that you're wanting to see. You had sent me some articles about Red Vienna that people can look up on the internet and see the different housing projects that still exist. And they are really extraordinary. People are listening to this program and go, you know, this is not something I'm aware of at all. Just even looking up on the internet, Red Vienna, and then starting to do kind of a crawl through the internet is really eye-opening about this little landlocked country that had this experience of this little utopia. I really want to thank you, Eve, for bringing all of this today and for sharing it with us and sharing this book. And I look forward to the next two books in the series. And
great.
I appreciate hearing about this, and I appreciate a chance to talk with you about this today. You've been listening to Eve Newhouse, author of Red Vienna. And next week, please join me and my guests, Jim Dee and Skylar McLennan, as we talk about the changes to the Palm Theater in San Luis Obispo with Jim's retirement and what it means for the San Luis Obispo Film Festival and film entertainment in San Luis Obispo County. I'm Chris Kington Barker, and I want to thank you for joining us today for Central Coast Voices.